Joel Sartori has made a name for himself in the world of portrait photography. Though to get a feel for his subjects, you might try looking at National Geographic magazine. NPR's Claire O'Neill spent a morning with the photographer to see how he works.
I'm the only studio portrait photographer I know whose subjects routinely poop and pee on the background right in front of me.
And they can get away with it, because in case you haven't figured it out, Joel Sartori's subjects are animals. Bugs, tigers, birds, frogs, you name it, he'll shoot it. Today, at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, it's a razor-billed bird, that's the oinking you hear, and a puffin, little black and white guys with bright orange beaks.
He's just standing there with the back of his head to me. I gotta have an eye or something to be able to show how pretty he is, even in winter plumage.
We're cramped in this backroom refrigerator. There are two animal handlers, two birds, Sartori, his four-piece light kit, two cameras, power generators, backdrops. It's a total production. When he's not on assignment for Geographic, Sartori is doing this, traveling to the country's zoos and aquariums.
The goal of this project is to get people to look these things in the eye before they go extinct. Not everything I shoot is rare, but a lot is.
He estimates about 6,000 species are represented in zoos, and he's already shot about a third of them.
I supplement this by going out on these Geographic shoots around the world and photograph the lions in the trees at sunset and koala bears in Australia. But what I want to do is go to the world's zoos and aquariums and photograph all these species while I can. I just figure for a lot of these species, these pictures are all that's going to remain.
And Sartori is serious about this. He once drove clear across the country to photograph a fly. Also on today's agenda is a turtle. He's really into turtles.
This is our spot. It's a stainless steel countertop. We're going to get some clamps out. We're going to get ready for a big turtle shoot, big turtle rodeo. A couple of clamps that go right there.
Sartori is talkative, friendly, Midwestern. Nice, his red t-shirt says Nebraska in big white letters. That's where he lives with his wife and three kids when he's not on the road, where he bought 1,200 acres just to save a rare bird. He's known among photographers for his book Rare, Studio Portraits of Endangered Species. He photographs on plain backgrounds, but as far as he's concerned, everything is in some kind of danger, and he wants to capture it all.
We have a very non-nature-based life. That's why zoos and aquariums are so important. It's the only place now where the public can go and actually see something without it being on a screen. It's real. These things are real.
At the end of the day, we're sitting in his Prius. It's his studio mobile, packed to the gills with equipment. Today, he got two birds, the turtle, an iguana, an Australian prickly stick that hopped onto his lens. 4 hours, five animals, not bad. But that's only half the battle. Sartori wants people to see them.
Look these species in the eye and tell me you don't care about them. They're amazing, and they're funny, and they're sad, and they're lazy, and they're energetic, and they're mean, and they're aggressive, and they're everything we are.
Except not quite potty trained. Sartori has been blogging his zoo project on Geographic's website and selling prints to raise money. Only 4,000 left to go. Leave it to this guy to get it done. Claire O'Neill, NPR News.
You can see Joel Sartori at work and some of his images on our website, npr.org.
And among the animals he's been photographing over the years are these small monkeys called cotton-top tamarins. There are only about 100 of them left in captivity, including a female who was stolen and then returned to a zoo in Australia about a year ago. The animal, named Conchetta, was pregnant at the time but miscarried during that whole ordeal.
Now, happily, Conchetta has given birth. For the first time, reports the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, only three cotton-top tamarins were born all of last year. Zoo officials said they won't know the gender of Conchetta's baby for months, and they'll ask the public for help in choosing its name.
Today, we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of a book that launched the career of Theodore Geisel. You may know him better as Dr. Seuss. Before he rocked the culinary world with green eggs and ham and put a red and white striped top hat on a talking cat, Dr. Seuss was stuck on a boat returning from a trip to Europe. For 8 days, he listened to the ship's engine chug away. It probably sounded something like this. The sound got stuck in his head, and he started writing to the rhythm. Eventually, he had his first children's book. It was called And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. The book is about a boy named Marco who wants to tell his dad an interesting story about what he saw that day. But the only thing Marco's seen is a boring old horse and wagon.
That's nothing to tell of, you know, that won't do, of course. Just a broken down wagon that's drawn by a horse. That can't be my story.
No.
That's only a start. I'll say that a zebra was pulling that cart.
That's a story that no one can beat. When you say that you saw it on Mulberry Street.
That reading is from the movie In Search of Dr. Seuss. In the end, Marco knows his father won't tolerate a made-up story, and so the dejected little boy just tells his dad the boring truth. Dr. Seuss didn't have an easy time selling this bittersweet story to publishers.
It was rejected 27 times.
That's Guy McLean. He works in Massachusetts at the Springfield Museum. That's in Dr. Seuss's hometown. McLean became a local expert on Dr. Seuss, and he says Mulberry Street may have never been published were it not for a chance encounter Dr. Seuss had one day.
He bumped into a friend as he was walking home in New York City, who had just become an editor at a publishing house in the children's section. He said that he had given up, he was going to destroy the book, and this editor said, well, let me take a look at it, and that led to the publication of the book.
It was a moment that changed Dr. Seuss's life.
He said if he had been walking down the other side of the street, he probably would never have become a children's author.
The book was published, it got great reviews, and the rest is history. But why Mulberry Street, you might ask? Turns out it's a real-life street in Dr. Seuss's hometown. Guy McLean's been there.
It was a street very close to his grandparents' bakery. And I think also, too, it was the rhythm, the sound of the word that was very important with Dr. Seuss, because there's nothing special about the street, really.
But really, that ordinary street launched one extraordinary career. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
Finally this hour, a story of a bakery started by Jewish immigrants and rescued by Pakistani Muslim immigrants. Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels claims to be the oldest Bialy bakery in New York City. It was founded in 1920, but it's faced hard times and changing demographics. As NPR's Margot Adler reports, the bakery is still alive and still kosher.
Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels makes everything by hand the old-fashioned way. Zafaryab Ali, who worked in the bakery for 11 years before leaving to drive a cab and now runs the shop along with his partner Pirzada Shah, gives me the abbreviated bagel tour.
Cinnamon raisin, plain bagel, sesame, poppy I have, onion, pumpernickel.
It's a small store being slowly renovated in a kind of rundown area on Coney Island Avenue, but the customers know what they like.
Scoop out the dough on both sides with a little butter.
Jeannie Whitson works in a nearby store.
I love their bialys, and I like their flagels.
What are
That's
these?
A flat bagel. Then that is doughy.
And today you're getting what?
I'm getting cranberry with a little butter.
The store was founded by Morris Rosenzweig, who came from Bialystok at the turn of the century, where bialys originated. Bialys usually have an indentation in the middle, but it's not a hole like a bagel, and often some onions in the middle or other flavoring. At one point, the bakery did so much business, it was open 24 hours a day on the weekends. Later, the store was run by his son and then by Steve Ross, his grandson, now in his 50s.
By the time I was 10, 11 years old, I was working at cash register. I had to stand on a milk case. By 12, 13 years old, I was, you know, making bialys. By 16, I was rolling bagels. You know, so I worked literally the bottom up.
Ross also worked as a firefighter until he got injured on the job. He's had three surgeries. He couldn't easily commute from New Jersey to take care of the shop. Also, the neighborhood changed. Ross says many of the traditional customers moved to the suburbs. He tried to sell the business. There were no buyers. And when Ali heard about it, Ross asked him, want to take it over?
And then we take charge. Then I said, okay, we'll try, you know.
Shah and Ross say not much has changed.
I'm using same recipe, same ingredients from same suppliers.
I gave them all the phone numbers. If you need, you know, this is who you're going to get it from. And they stayed with all that.
For the bagels, that means high gluten flour, brown sugar, liquid malt, making them by hand, not by machine, boiling them, not steaming them before they are baked. As for keeping the bakery kosher.
Kosher and halal is very, very close, like a brother and sister, maybe twin, you know.
Ali and Shah say the only thing remaining is official kosher supervision and certification.
Very soon we go to bring rabbi for blessing.
I'm looking for that.
Ross, Shah, and Ali talk to each other at least several times a week. They all say business is picking up. And when people look askance at the idea of Muslims running a kosher Jewish bakery, Ross has this response.
They were reliable. I taught them everything. There was never any arguments. I wish them well.
Truthfully, I didn't want to believe these bagels were any better than those at my local deli, which are half the price. But the verdict after buying a dozen and bringing them back to the office, my deli lost. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Chris Nelson.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Art Silverman, Jonathan Baer, Rob Ballinger, Brendan Banasek, Greg Dixon, Theo Balcom, Melissa Gray, and Jessica Deal.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. In rural China, it's not uncommon for school children to skip lunch. Not because they're too busy, they're simply too poor. Well, thanks largely to the efforts of one man, 25,000 poverty-stricken children in China are now getting a free lunch every day. And indirectly, his efforts have helped millions more. NPR's Louisa Lim has the story from Shanxi.
For 10-year-old Xie Xiaoyuan, just getting to school is an ordeal. Her frostbitten ears a testament to this. I get up at 5 o'clock, she says. Then I comb my hair and start walking. She navigates a mountain path in the dark, trudging through snowstorms and mudslides. Then she has to get a bus for about 10 miles. She hasn't time to eat breakfast. For lunch, I spend 15 cents on 2 pieces of bread and a drink, she says. That's all she eats until dinner at home at 5 o'clock. That's all her family can afford, with an income of about $120 a month for 5 people. For a while, she even stopped going to school because they couldn't afford the bus fare. But they were told this is against the law. Many of her fellow students at Hujiaying Primary School go hungry every day. Headmaster Bai Baojun says his biggest challenge is left behind kids, those whose parents have gone to the cities to make money.
About 80% of our kids have parents who've gone away to find work. For half our students, both parents have gone away, so they depend on their grandparents, who can't help with their homework.
China's growing income disparity can be seen here, not just in the dirt roads and lack of sanitation, but in the very bodies of these kids. As they do their daily exercises in the playground, they're warmly wrapped up, since the classrooms have no heating. But one recent survey found 12% of children in the poorest rural regions are stunted due to malnourishment. They're on average 2 to 6 inches shorter than city kids. One new grassroots program aims to change that by providing free lunches for countryside children. Through the internet, it solicits donations of less than 50 cents, enough for one meal per child per day. These are then donated to schools in the poorest places in China. At this school, the money pays for these basins of meat and tofu, which are being cooked in enormous metal vats. The school chef is cooking for more than 200. There's so much food in there, he's actually using a shovel to stir the food. Headmaster Bai gives a speech to mark the first official day of free lunch at the school.
Now we're actually trying the free lunch. There's a spicy tofu dish, celery with meat, and mushrooms and greens, and it's actually really, really good. I would pay a lot more in a restaurant for this.
The kids line up eagerly. For most, this is the best meal of the day. Some, without parents here, even have to cook their own supper. This program is the brainchild of Deng Fei, a campaigning journalist from Phoenix Weekly News magazine. But even he's been blown away by the speed with which the free lunch project has caught on.
In 8 months, we've raised $4 million in funds. 900,000 people gave us money. We've helped 162 schools give free lunches to 25,000 children.
He's been working closely with local authorities, who sometimes contribute funds, in this case, building the school canteen. Since he started, the central government announced it will expand its own nutritional support program. It'll spend $2.5 billion, providing extra nutrition to 26 million Chinese kids in the countryside. Headmaster Bai believes Deng Fei's program prodded the government into action.
The government would probably have given some money for free lunches anyway, eventually. But I think it would have happened later.
In the dining room, the kids are wolfing down their food, giddy with joy. But this program is facing challenges, including how to monitor all the schools that take part. Here in Hujiayang, there are plans for a two-track system, with better meals for those that can pay more. Apparently, inequality is so entrenched in China that even within a poverty alleviation program, there are haves and have-nots. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
A new study finds that chemicals known as PFCs can impair a child's immune system. PFCs are found in nonstick coatings, stain-resistant fabrics, food packaging, and even some seafood. Their use is declining in the U.S., but as NPR's John Hamilton reports, exposure to even relatively low levels seems to have an effect.
In the past decade, scientists have become increasingly concerned about PFCs, which are known formally as perfluorinated compounds. Philippe Grandjean, who works at Harvard and the University of Southern Denmark, says one reason is that PFCs are just about impossible to avoid.
These compounds have been around for like 50 years. I mean, you can find them in polar bears, and they're all over the environment.
Also, PFCs tend to linger for years in the body, and in lab animals, they've been shown to suppress the immune system. Grandjean wanted to know whether this was happening in children, so he led a team that studied nearly 600 kids in the Faroe Islands, which lie about halfway between Scotland and Iceland. The Faroese have levels of PFCs similar to those of U.S. residents. Grandjean figured that if the chemicals were having an effect, it would show up in the way the kids' bodies responded to vaccinations. Normally, a vaccine causes the production of lots of antibodies to a specific germ, but Grandjean says that response was less pronounced in the children whose blood contained higher levels of PFCs.
We found that the higher the exposure, the less capable the kids were in terms of responding appropriately to the vaccine. And some of the kids were more or less incapable.
The study looked at the responses to vaccines for diphtheria and tetanus in children from 5 to 7 years old. Grandjean says the results suggest these kids have a blunted response to other vaccines as well, and perhaps bigger problems.
Of course, we worry that something more serious is going on here, that the immune system is not really developing optimally.
If so, children with higher levels of PFCs might be less able to fight off infectious diseases. Alan Duckettman from West Virginia University has worked on something known as the C8 Health Project, which has been studying the health effects of one particular PFC in Ohio and West Virginia. He says results from the new study are consistent with some of their own findings regarding PFCs and immune function.
PFCs have certainly undergone a transformation in our perspective on them over one decade.
Doug Inman says consumers in the U.S. have reason to be concerned, even though companies here have phased out some PFCs and some exposure levels have begun falling. Doug Inman says PFCs are not the most frightening chemicals out there.
But they are also clearly problematic and something to think about. And to the degree that levels are going down in the United States, we should also acknowledge that they're not going down in other parts of the world. And in fact, there are places where they may even be going up.
Grandjean says China is one country that appears to be using more PFCs these days, and they are putting them in products that get sold in the U.S.
We may just be importing products with the same compounds instead. So I don't think that we have solved the exposure problem yet, and I think it needs international attention.
It's getting some. Global treaties are just beginning to include language restricting the use of certain PFCs. The new study appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now another in our series, Setting Out, where we profile recent college graduates looking for work. Melanie Singer graduated 18 months ago from the University of Dayton into one of the worst job markets in recent history. She did have reason to be optimistic. She had majored in accounting, she'd gone to career counseling, and completed several internships. As Emily McCord from member station WYSO reports, it took Melanie Singer longer than she thought it would to find a job.
You can smell chicken cooking in the oven. It's warm and clean in Melanie Singer's first apartment. And what's more important, it's not where she was right after graduation in the spring of 2010, living back home with her parents.
I mean, I felt like I shouldn't be living with them. I have a college degree and I, you know, should be on my own. And it's time for me to grow up and move on.
There's a knock at the door.
Hey.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Eric Krissick is Melanie's boyfriend. In 2010, Melanie was looking for a job in Dayton, in part to be close to him. Now he's come over so they can make dinner together.
Do you want to cut up the peppers? They're sitting out there. You can just cut them up.
Sure.
Thanks.
In the little pieces?
They're both busy with work, so dinner on a weeknight is special. It took Melanie a whole year after graduation to find work as an accountant, a field that was supposed to be a surefire path to employment.
I even remember I looked over my books, like my accounting books, before I started, just because I was nervous that I wasn't going to remember something important.
Now, she balances the spreadsheets every month and reconciles the accounts, all of the things that her college degree prepared her to do.
For once, like, it felt like, okay, like, this all this work is finally paying off.
And now with her job, she's paying off her $15,000 in student loans. Let's go back for a moment to that time when Melanie was unemployed. She'd gone interview after interview and sent out more resumes than she can remember. After a while, she said, it took a toll on her.
When you see something exciting, you get really excited. Okay, you know, but you don't want to get your hopes up either. I don't know, you always want to put the blame on yourself. What did I do wrong? Did I say something in the interview that was wrong? Am I, you know, not qualified? Like, I don't know, you know, but what can I do better? Like, what? I obviously did something wrong, you know.
And even now, when she hears herself 18 months later, her eyes well up thinking about that time.
I feel like I've grown up now, and I've become that independent individual. It's a much better feeling than feeling like you're hopeless and living off someone else.
Shoot, the chicken was not done.
Okay.
The biggest one.
Look at
I didn't
you.
Take the smaller ones.
Good job.
Thanks.
In the kitchen, Melanie's boyfriend Eric is frying up some peppers to go with that chicken.
There's a big difference in her probably personality as far as how confident she is.
Eric, who's a middle school math teacher, says now they can talk about their days at work when they sit down to dinner. Before, it was nerve-wracking to talk about job stuff because Melanie's news usually wasn't good.
She was working her tail off to try and find anything, and it just kept coming up empty, so it was really difficult.
During that time, Melanie says she learned patience and perseverance and what it means to take responsibility for her own life.
That was definitely the next stage that I was looking for.
Melanie likes making facts and figures balance, so being an accountant suits her. And this year is extra exciting. This will be the first time she's doing her own federal and state tax returns. Still, when it comes to the future, she's not taking any chances. Melanie Singer is going back to school at night to get her MBA, just in case. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord.